This is URN.
Hello, you are listening to The Identity Talk. I'm Ibi, my pronouns are he and him.
My name is Ant, my pronouns are they and she and her.
And my name is Helix and my pronoun is Xierd, spelled X-I-E-R-D.
Thank you very much for joining me today, and thank you to those who are listening for joining us on air. We have a very special episode today. The United Nations General Assembly has just held a vote and is holding another one as we speak about global LGBT rights, and they're very, very crucial votes that are currently taking place. So we will be basing our entire episode around a discussion of global rights, and we'll be going into the two UN votes later on in the show itself. But first, I'd actually quite like to start off by discussing the state of LGBT rights across the world. Being in a British university, we are very fortunate in that we are based at an institution in a country which has a very good track record of LGBT rights. At least it does now. Obviously, historically, Britain has been problematic. But with regards to the current state of LGBT rights, we are in one of the better countries in the world. Within the European index, it is consistently in the top three countries. Same-sex marriage is recognized. Trans rights are getting an increasing level of recognition, including the decriminalization of transgender identities as a mental disorder. And that was quite a recent improvement in the NHS system. But the situation worldwide is a lot more complex. And one of the best places to look at that gives you a very good description, statistically speaking, of LGBT rights worldwide is a website called equaldex.com. So if anyone has an interest in checking that out, that is a very, very good website. At the moment, and I'm just going to be reading out a few basic statistics here. The decriminalization, or rather I should say the criminalization of same-sex intimacy is still illegal in 73 countries. And this is actually down from 76 last year, 76 at the beginning of last year. So three countries have, since the beginning of 2015 up until now, decriminalized same-sex activity. So that's a very positive step in the right direction. Now, of those 73 countries where same-sex intimacy is still a criminal offence, 40 are based off of a British imperial era law called Section 377. Those 40 countries are all in the Commonwealth of Nations, and there is an ongoing discussion as to whether Britain has a moral responsibility to address that, and that is something we will be coming into later on in the show. Also among the 73 countries are 9 countries, the majority of which are based in the Middle East, who carry capital punishment for being LGBT. This, of course, doesn't include extrajudicial violence against LGBT individuals, such as the ongoing attacks against the transgender community in the United States, or the attacks by Islamic extremist groups such as ISIS against the LGBT community. So this is specifically with regards to national legislation and national law. But on the flip side to that, 148 countries have officially decriminalized homosexuality, and this is three countries up from the beginning of 2015. Used to be 145, has now moved up to 148. So moves in the right direction, but, you know, still more work to be done. Same-sex marriage is officially recognized in 40 countries, but another 94 countries recognize some level of same-sex unions. So just to make that distinction then, in 40 countries, same-sex marriage is fully recognized, as was the case in the United States after Obergefell versus Hodges was passed last year, as was also the case in Ireland after their marriage referendum was held.
I just have to ask you, with marriage, you really mean a marriage equal to heterosexual marriage and not civil partnership or
yes,
something?
Yes, okay. full marriage rights.
With all the laws?
Yes, okay. Yes. A country that is currently debating it is Taiwan, which is looking to become the first ever Asian country to constitutionally recognize same-sex marriage. Both Nepal and Vietnam are countries that do not have any constitutional blocks to same-sex marriage, but if Taiwan passes its amendment, it will become the first Asian country to actually specifically recognize same-sex unions in a constitutional capacity. Of course, on the flip side, 102 countries specifically state that marriage is between a man and a woman. So there are still 102 countries where same-sex marriage is constitutionally illegal. The right to legally change your gender, that is legal in 60 countries completely. And by that, we mean that there are very few conditions attached to it. You don't really have too many caveats. In 95 countries, it is possible to legally change gender, but there are quite a few hoops to jump through. And in a lot of cases, it still comes down to requiring permission of parents as well as the doctors, rather than through your own agency. And in 58 countries, it is completely illegal to change your gender. Same-sex adoption, fully legal in 58 countries. Legal to an extent with some conditions in 41 countries, and completely illegal in over 100. But you also have a few things that are very positive. So, for example, protection rights against LGBT discrimination exist in some form or another in 62 countries, with a further 45 countries recognizing some levels of LGBT discrimination protection laws. Housing discrimination is specifically protected against in 56 countries. Employment discrimination is specifically protected in 55 countries.
Something that I'm noticing is when we're looking at the statistics on Equal Dex, a significant proportion of the protections exist in Europe and South America, whereas Oceania, North America and are lesser, and the countries particularly lacking are Africa and Asia. What's really interesting though is that I know that we haven't quite reached this yet, but there is a statistic for the equal age of consent.
Yes.
Europe is almost completely protected on that. And in terms of equal age of consent, that exists in 146 countries and it's unequal in the remaining 75. What's really interesting continuing to see that is that Oceania and North America are significantly higher on equalizing the age of consent than they are on issues such as housing discrimination, LGBT discrimination. North America is really low on homosexuals serving openly in the military, which has been a contentious issue in the past. But that's just really important in terms of how we really treat LGBT issues, because when we're talking about the age of consent, that's really, really important in determining legal cases and determining issues, particularly marriage, because it's like how important is one's own agency and how important is being LGBT in the wider cultural context.
Indeed. Another thing that has recently come into contention is blood donations, and this is a particularly worrying statistic in that only 24 countries allow donations by people who partake in same-sex intimacy, and it is illegal in 193 countries, and that includes the entirety of Oceania. A lot of people would assume that there are some continents and some parts of the world that stereotypically, at least, or conventionally carry more equal rights, but that is probably the most worrying one in terms of allowing blood donations. And of course, this was something that came into light particularly after the Pulse shooting in Orlando, the Pulse nightclub shooting, where there was not only a huge outcry about the targeting of the LGBT community, but there was a specific outcry against, once that targeting had happened, how a lot of gay men were then unable to go and support their own community by donating blood. And that was something that is becoming more of a talking point, particularly in countries such as Northern Ireland and Ireland, where the blood ban, or the blood donation ban, is still very much in effect. Something that has actually improved massively, and this is a huge step up from just 2015, is the statistic regarding conversion therapy. Now, conversion therapy is a therapy in which countries...
We use therapy loosely.
Well, we use therapy very, very loosely. I would prefer not to use it at all. But the pseudoscience of conversion therapy is the belief that someone who is LGBT is LGBT by choice, and that certain forms of medical treatment, and again we use that word very, very loosely, can be used to change their orientation and their identity. At the beginning of 2015, according to EqualDex, only 3 countries banned conversion therapy. This has now moved up to 42. And although that is by no means the majority of the world, that is a huge, huge step in the right direction to see that so many countries are actively banning conversion therapy. And again, we use the word therapy very loosely as a form of trying to change LGBT identities. Now, we've just gone through a lot of statistics, and I realize that some of them are slightly difficult to digest in such a short amount of time. But what seems to be the case and what seems to be coming up is that there is a certain level of progress within the wider LGBT rights movement. But there are also some very specific areas which are particularly worrying. So, for example, the decriminalization of same-sex intimacy has improved, and it is one of the few statistics that we read out where the majority of the countries do not criminalize being LGBT, or at least being LGB. And that's a good sign. But then on the flip side, a similar level in terms of the statistics regarding LGBT protections and LGBT anti-discrimination laws is very, very low. So I'm opening this up for a moment. What do you think about the inevitable overlap, if you look at the numbers there, of countries which do not criminalize LGBT identities, but at the same time do not provide protections for the LGBT community? What do we think of that?
To start off with, I think that in terms of a country acknowledging the fact that its citizens exist, I think that by directly not implementing protections for citizens that are LGBTQ+, it is a form of disenfranchisement, because you're effectively refusing to recognize that they exist and that they lead lives, and that it definitely comes from a position of privilege, or a position of whereby issues that are not very well publicized or aren't made that common aren't seen as very important, or they aren't seen as something that should be worried about. And I know that later on in the show we're going to be talking about the votes happening at the UN and why particularly the African nations are trying to take down the position of LGBT protection
within the UN Security Council,
exactly.
Rather within the UN Human Rights Commission. I beg your pardon, wrong body there.
Due to apparently the wrongful prioritization of LGBT individuals on a global scale. And I think it's mainly to do with how people perceive LGBTQ issues and how important they are. And if you haven't had much exposure to people that have been through struggles such as, or if you don't have many people that have experienced homophobia, that have experienced conversion therapy, if it's not a very close issue to you, like there is some proximal distance there, and cultural ideas on how we should treat LGBT people can really influence that, because if someone is seen as an outsider, that's not someone that you should care about. It doesn't fit into your sphere of things that are important. And it should be, I think that it's so, so important that it's the LGBTQ+ identities are fully protected from the outset, because it legitimizes hate crime, it legitimizes homophobia and biphobia and transphobia as well. And it not only gives legal protection, but social protection, because it gives you a solid grounding on which to base, well, no, you can't treat me like this because my country protects me, my country recognizes me, I am here, I exist, and can touch this. Mm-hmm.
Would you argue that in some of those countries, and again, for anyone who's using EqualDex, if you scan through the individual statistics, you also get a breakdown of which countries in particular, but there are a few countries on there which have said that they used to have LGBT protection rights, or rather protection laws, specifically in their statute books, but have removed them because of the current tolerant nature. Very few of them, I will say this very much straight off the outset, but have removed them because they no longer class LGBT as a protected minority. Now, without necessarily going into the veracity of these statements and without necessarily questioning them, because obviously that is a case-by-case basis and that would need a lot more time, do we think that that as a statement is a sign of progress?
I think that... I don't know how we would define progress here, because as we've seen on Equal Dex, there are countries that we would consider progressive, air quotations, because of their Western geographical location, such as the US. However, the US has a shockingly low number of, and even Australia as well, or Oceania, there was a shockingly low statistics in terms of protection for blood donation and housing protection. And it's just so interesting because there were countries such as Asia, or continents like Asia and Africa, which are traditionally a bit less progressive, but that still had that tiny proportion of, you know, we're protecting people, there is some kind of legislation there. So I think that we need to be really careful with how we use the word progressive, and especially in Western rhetoric. A lot of the news that we see is surrounding how good it is that this certain politician or that this certain legislation is being passed. And I think we need to examine proportionally, how big is this in the grand scale?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because some places just have a lot further to go. So I think that when there is a little step, like a little move forward,
mm-hmm.
in a place that we might not consider as always newsworthy, that's so, so important, because you need those building blocks to build on and develop your LGBTQ plus friendly policies.
Absolutely. I think we're going to leave that discussion here for the moment. We've just covered, if you just tuned in, we have just covered a discussion regarding the state of LGBTQ plus rights worldwide, using Equal Dex as a comparative point. So again, very good website if you're looking for those statistics. You can send in messages at urn1350.net. You can also tweet us at urn1350 and at The Identity Talk. If you're tweeting live during the show, please include URN1350, because that will show up on our messaging system. But you can also tweet at The Identity Talk after the show so that we can continue these discussions outside of the 1 hour that we have right now. When we come back from our first song break, we'll be going into a discussion regarding the legislations, regarding the votes that are currently taking place at the United Nations General Assembly, both of which are very key points and key moments in the global fight for LGBT rights. One of the votes concluded just an hour before the show, the other one is still ongoing, but we will be continuing our discussions regarding that. Now, the United Nations General Assembly, which is the body within the UN which every single UN member is a part of, so it's the biggest single body of the UN, has held one vote and is holding another vote currently regarding LGBT rights. The vote that has just passed, and it passed an hour before the start of the show, was regarding the universalization of LGBT rights. So the motion that was put in, was to recognize that LGBT rights are part of a general standard of UN human rights. And as a reminder, the UN in 1948 signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a means of recognizing a standard level of human rights across the world. There have been several amendments that have been made to that declaration. So, for example, when the United Nations passed a specific resolution regarding children's rights, that was then included into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the hope is that today's vote will be a step towards including LGBT rights in the wider UN declaration. So that was a vote that happened earlier today.
Well, I have to ask again. So all people at that conference are part of the United Nations, right?
Yes.
And but so how is it possible their ambassadors can decide whether to vote or to vote against that protocol?
Right. So the way that the UN General Assembly votes work is that the UN sends... or rather, each country sends an ambassador to the United Nations. And the ambassador represents that country, specifically that country's government at the time. So every time there's a change in government, a new UN ambassador is chosen. To give an example, after the most recent United States elections, there will be a new UN ambassador that will go. It is very possible that Theresa May would have chosen a new UN ambassador, although because the government party didn't change, that didn't necessarily have to happen. So every time there's a change in administration, a new ambassador to the UN can be selected. With the General Assembly, as I said, every member country of the UN is part of that voting body. But what can happen... and this is very similar to parliamentary votes in the UK, for example, not every member has to be present for every single vote. So although there is a certain number of countries that are part of the General Assembly, that doesn't mean they're always present for every single vote. This one had a very high turnout, however. And I want to just point out to people who are listening, this was what is known as a non-binding resolution. So there are two types of General Assembly resolutions. One is a non-binding resolution, which is basically a resolution that commits the United Nations as an organization to the decision, but individual countries still don't have to sign it. And usually a non-binding resolution is the first step in a wider move towards greater rights. A binding resolution is one where even if you vote against the motion on the floor of the UN, if the resolution passes, you still have to abide by it. So in this particular instance, the countries that didn't vote in favour of it can choose not to listen to the resolution. But usually these resolutions are then carried forward into a more formal process. And for a non-binding resolution, all you need is 50% of the voting countries. So not 50% of the entire General Assembly, but 50% of however many countries are present to vote in favour of. And the current voting tally for this particular resolution said that 84 countries voted in favour of it, 77 countries voted against it, and 17 countries abstained from voting. And abstention means that their votes are basically a spoiled ballot. And in terms of what the numbers, or how the numbers work out, their votes don't count as a total. So 84 plus 7, you know, and 84 versus 77, 84 is the greater number, it's the majority of votes, therefore the resolution passed. They've also released an actual full list of countries which voted in favour of and against. So if anyone here wants to know whether specific countries voted in favour or not, for example, my home country of Bangladesh, where LGB rights are very, very restricted, being LGB is still a criminal offence, being trans isn't, but it still carries a huge number of risks, Bangladesh voted against the resolution, which, as much as it saddens me, doesn't come as a surprise. The United Kingdom also, unsurprisingly, voted in favour of the resolution. So we do have countries that have very specific reasons for voting for or voting against.
Can I just ask, what positions did Belize and Jamaica vote?
You're asking for very personal reasons, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bit, but mainly just because I know that Belize just very recently decriminalized gay marriage and same-sex intimacy as well. So I'm actually very interested to see how we did vote, but also the United States, I'm quite interested to see what happened there.
Well, Jamaica voted against the resolution.
Surprise, surprise.
And Jamaica, as a reminder, is a country that is slightly ambiguous regarding its position on LGBT rights in that they don't actually have a lot of laws that are restricted of LGBT identities.
But on the flip side, there's almost no protection.
Exactly.
There basically is no protection.
Absolutely. The United States voted in favour of the resolution, which is also unsurprising, especially given the Supreme Court decisions regarding LGBT rights. And as a reminder for people who might be surprised, given the incoming administration's LGBT discriminatory rhetoric. The current LGBT, or the current US ambassador to the UN, is still from Barack Obama's administration, who is probably the single most LGBT-friendly president in US history. Belize, especially since having recently decriminalized homosexuality, voted in favor of the
Yay!
Resolution.
So congratulations. Oh, I have faith in humanity again, almost. Yes. Getting there.
The majority of the countries that voted against were from the African bloc. The remaining countries were from the Asian and Middle East bloc. Mm-hmm. There were no countries from Europe that voted against. There were no countries from the North American or South American bloc that voted against, although there were a few countries from South America that did abstain from the vote. Mm-hmm. South and Central America. So Ecuador, Barbados, Haiti, these are all countries that didn't actually take part in, or Trinidad and Tobago as well. They refused to place a vote. And Asian countries that didn't place a vote include India, Nepal, Myanmar, and also, I just had it on me, Myanmar. Oh, no, I just said Myanmar. I'm sorry. It's a very long list. It's a little difficult to sometimes keep track of this. So there are some countries that voted or that chose not to vote based on their official national positions. But it was in some ways a closer vote than people would have liked.
I was going to say 77 to 84 is a shockingly close vote. That's like referendum close vote.
Yeah. And there are also some countries that going into the vote could be considered a wild card. They didn't really have a strong position in either case. South Africa, for instance, because it was part of the wider Asian voting bloc, some observers were worried that South Africa wouldn't vote in favour of, but they did, particularly because they have a strong constitutional commitment to anti-discrimination across the board. And I think that is in some ways something that has come into this particular voting situation quite strongly, is the fact that there are countries that had a very specific approach to this vote. So to give a comparison, countries like the Netherlands, which voted in favor very strongly because they believe in protecting LGBT rights specifically. Some countries that voted in favor, such as South Africa, didn't necessarily vote because of LGBT rights, but because they believe in a blanket acceptance of human rights across the board. But there are also some countries that didn't vote in favor, such as Nigeria, which say that they have a strong commitment towards equal rights, but they believe that LGBT rights go against equal rights in a cultural and social context of Nigerian identity. So there are a lot of different things at play. And that's what I'd like to open up for discussion now, if I may. What do we think about this idea? Do we think that rights can be universal? Do we think that rights can and should be universal? Or do we think that even with something that might seem as morally secure as rights, different contexts still come into play?
Well, first of all, of course, I think everyone should gain the same right. And talking about morality, we really have to be careful what the reasons for morality, whether it's from a special philosophy or religion and so on. It always depends how you... what point of view you have, and I think we maybe should discuss whether there's just one way of thinking that should be should be clear around the world.
Right.
Okay, so I'm going to skew my answer a little bit toward the US, but not in the way that people might expect.
Sure.
I think that it depends how people view LGBT people. Again, it depends whether you see someone that's asking for LGBT rights protection as a unique special snowflake, or if you see that as LGBT rights as a full, as one part of a multidimensional rights protection for everyone. And what's really interesting is that, particularly with the African nations that are opposing the LGBT protection in the United Nations is that they don't see, or it would, I would imagine, that being LGBT or sexual orientation, who people are attracted to, is not seen as a cohesive part of someone's identity, both socially and culturally, enough to warrant legal protection and legislation. Sure. So I think that what we need to think about is when you're talking about protecting someone's rights, like you said with South Africa when they voted, it's if you're voting in favor of something because you view someone's protection, if you view someone's sexual orientation as a significant, just part of a blanket rights protection, then I feel like you have to be very considerate of others' views. You have to take an intersectional approach to it, because what some people might perceive as a blanket statement of rights may be ignoring a lot of aspects that they just may not have experienced themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that what the Netherlands is doing, and what countries that explicitly make a point of protecting LGBTQ plus identities, I think that is very, very responsible, because it acknowledges that you are part of a wider community, even if issues don't potentially affect you, even if it potentially may happen. Not that it's... essentially, there is no room for issues to be ignored, mm-hmm. per se. And I think that that's very responsible. But, and I think that there is a lot of danger in just assuming that there is only one blanket statement and everyone should just assume that sexuality falls under that, because for a lot of people it doesn't. But what I was looking at on an article that I was looking at on my phone, it's from The Inquisitor, and it's about Donald Trump's stance on LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. Now, what we were talking about, how the US voted in favor and how the US delegate at the United Nations is from the Obama administration, which means that, you know, we would assume a progressive view. However, this is about Donald Trump's view on homosexuality in general. And he, apparently for the past 16 years, he has made many quotes saying that he condemned the ineffective don't ask, don't tell policy in the military. He says, "I grew up in New York City, a town with different races, religions. It breeds tolerance. In all truth, I don't care whether or not a person is gay. I judge people based on their capability, honesty, and merit." And yes, that is Donald Trump, if you didn't believe it, or at least one of his spokespeople. Mm-hmm. He also condemned George Bush for being a disappointment, for having the opportunity in Texas to show national leadership by passing a hate crimes bill, but didn't, presumably from pressure from the Christian right. And I think one of the most enlightening quotes that we can find here is where he says that, "I would want the best and brightest. Sexual orientation would be meaningless. I'm looking for brains and experience. If the best person for the job happens to be gay, I would certainly appoint them." And I think we should acknowledge that when he was thinking of who he would appeal to with his audience, he did tell, or at least he did tweet to Caitlyn Jenner, that she was welcome in Trump Tower anytime. He did not discriminate against her because she was trans. However, I think that if you're going to say, "I would want to ignore an aspect of someone's identity or ignore an aspect of their character on which they could be potentially prejudiced against or on which they could be discriminated against," if you're choosing to ignore that, you are being directly irresponsible, whether you're as a person or as a country when you're forming your legislation. And whether you consider yourself LGBTQ plus friendly or not, that it's like the argument of saying, "Oh, I'm not racist, I have black friends," but at the same time, yeah, Black Lives right. Matter is a pointless movement because all lives matter. Or if you want mm-hmm. to see the whole, you have to deconstruct the parts and acknowledge that every single one of them exists and make sure that it's protected in terms of identity.
So I think what we can say from this part of the discussion is that as individuals on this panel, we're leaning very much towards an understanding that LGBT rights, specifically as their own rights, do need to be protected. Mm-hmm. And part of that comes from the fact that LGBT identities are specifically discriminated against.
Yeah.
So while it is good that there are countries that did vote in favor of this resolution because they believe in human rights across the board, and while it is very good that their numbers counted for the vote, it would perhaps be slightly more constructive to take a stand and say it's not just that human rights as a whole should be protected, mm-hmm. but we need to acknowledge where human rights are failing, and LGBT discrimination is one of the areas in which human rights are failing.
And you would think that looking at hate crime statistics would boost that kind of legitimacy, but is so easy for the definition of a hate crime judicially to just be watered down or diluted and dismissed by any kind of court.
Now, you just touched on the topic of legality. We will be discussing that in the final part of today's show, because we will be going into a discussion on another vote that is currently taking place at the UN. The vote still hasn't come through, but that is based on a more legal technicality rather than a moral understanding of rights. So we will be touching on that side as well. You are listening to The Identity Talk. We've been doing a special episode today regarding LGBT rights. In the first part of the show, we discussed LGBT rights around the world, looking specifically at basic statistics provided by Equaldex, which is a very good resource for comparisons regarding LGBT rights. In the second part of the show, we discussed a recently passed, and when I say recently, I mean it was passed an hour before the show today, a recently passed UN resolution which morally protected LGBT rights as part of a universal commitment to human rights worldwide, with the slight caveat that this was a non-binding resolution, which means that the UN as a whole body and as a whole organization is now committed to LGBT rights, but individual countries within the UN can still choose not to accept that. What is happening right now at the UN, and this is an ongoing vote, so we don't actually have any updates on it. This is a vote that will be updated once the final results are out. But the African bloc of nations have provided, have brought up a fresh resolution. And they are challenging the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Council this year, earlier this year, introduced a special commissioner for LGBT rights. Just to point out, the Human Rights Council in the UN is probably one of the more effective bodies the UN has. There are some very real and very justified and valid criticisms of the United Nations as an organization. There are some parts of the UN which have proven to not be very effective at all. But on the other hand, there are some bodies that are, and the Human Rights Council, largely speaking, is one of those. And what the HRC, which is the Human Rights Council, what the HRC does is that they appoint specific individuals to look at specific concerns. So they have a commissioner for women's rights, they have a commissioner for children's rights, they have a commissioner against human trafficking, they have a commissioner for ethnic minority rights, and this year they introduced a commissioner for LGBT rights, which was seen as a landmark decision at the time it was made. Since that was passed, however, the African bloc of nations, supported by some parts of the Asian bloc of nations, particularly those countries from the Middle East, have started to suggest that this creation is an imposition of Western legality and Western rights across the world. They are not coming at it necessarily from a moral perspective, which is what we were discussing earlier on in the episode. They're coming at it from a legal perspective, where they are suggesting that a simple decision made by a majority of nations should not be taken as a universal decision, because that infringes on individual countries having their own decision making and having their own sovereignty. Now, I ask my fellow panelists what is probably a very loaded question, so I do very much appreciate that this probably isn't a question that can be answered in just 10 minutes, but we're going to try, or at the very least, we're going to try giving our opinions to start the ball rolling.
All right, let's give it a go.
So here's the question. Do we think, from an understanding which is as objective as we can make it, because we are very passionate and very personal about these issues, but do we think that when a majority of countries make a decision like the one that has been made regarding LGBT rights, that every country should follow that? Should this be a case of majority rules? Should this be a democratic decision?
Oof. Okay, right.
Bearing in mind that when in the process of democracy, it could go the other way as well. The majority of countries could have decided not to support LGBT rights, and we'd be having the same discussion.
Okay, so who wants to go first?
Oh, God.
Okay, I'll go first.
Thank you, I'm slow at thinking.
Okay, so I think that first off, we should acknowledge that some countries are more developed than others. Some countries have more resources at their disposal, and some countries have a different understanding of what it is to be educated in terms of life. And mm-hmm. in order for democracy to work, you need an educated electorate. So you need people to understand exactly what they're voting for and exactly why they're voting for it. And mm-hmm. while, as we spoke earlier, people will, or delegates will, approach this issue from a variety of standpoints, you do need... What's important about human rights is that they kind of unites moral legitimacy and legal legitimacy,
yes,
in one cohesive format. So mm-hmm. you've got, this is something that we uphold to be of moral worth, but it also has judicial worth and it is a legitimate aspect. So I think that when you're talking about human rights, you have to be very careful, because morality does vary culturally, and you have to be consider the legality of the situation in terms of where the delegate is coming from. But I think that because it takes a lot, I would imagine, of course this is purely hypothetical, mm-hmm. I would imagine that it takes a lot to unite something as subjective as morality with such a wide and legitimate authority as the United Nations. So when you've finally got a protection or a policy that works and is effective, when you have a commissioner for LGBTQ plus rights around the world that has, it's only been in place for a year, we can't properly mm-hmm. even measure whether it's been effective or ineffective in the long run because mm-hmm. of the shortness of this term. However, I think that in order for something to work, you have to see it through, and I think that it would be massively, massively detrimental to global LGBT rights if we were to shoot down, or if the African nations were to shoot down the position of the LGBT commissioner at the United Nations, particularly in light of the recent decriminalization of homosexuality in countries like Central America and Latin America, which is massively progressive mm-hmm. in terms of the step that it's made. And I think that we need to respect that if it is recognized by sources of authority, then we should respect that. And I think that other countries should at least provide some backing and support for a motion that would potentially protect rights instead of leaving them neglected. I think it's better to wager that you might end up protecting something than to leave something unprotected and vulnerable, especially if it's citizens of a country, or many for that matter.
Now, it's very interesting about the vote that is currently taking place is two countries that have very, very contradictory positions. Mm-hmm. But this is where, again, the question of legality versus the question of morality comes into play. Russia, which was a country that supported the resolution which made LGBT rights universal, has said that they are going to be supporting the African bloc for this vote because they feel that the Human Rights Council should not be overriding national sovereignty. So a country which did actually vote in favour of LGBT rights is, in this particular vote, now going to perhaps not undermine LGBT rights specifically, but are making a decision that will effectively undermine LGBT rights. On the flip side, Singapore, which is a country that criminalises homosexuality and which did not vote in favour of LGBT rights in the previous vote, have now gone ahead to say that from a legal perspective, they acknowledge that the Human Rights Council has the authority to override national sovereignty. So it's a very complicated situation mm-hmm. wherein two countries are actually flipping their positions because they are taking the moral argument out of their decision making and coming at it purely objectively from a legal point of view. And again, we do have to wonder, are individual nations and their sovereignty more important? I would like to humbly add here that I'm from a country where being LGB is still a criminal offence. I mentioned earlier on, I'm from Bangladesh. Being trans is not a criminal offence, which is slightly different from the global LGBT rights trends. I sincerely believe that human rights should be considered universal. Mm-hmm. And in that particular instance, my government's refusal to accept it should not be used as an excuse to say this is a Bangladeshi value, for example. So I do think that in that argument, certain bodies like the Human Rights Council do actually have a moral authority to override what could be seen as discriminatory laws nationally.
I think that we should all, I mean, if you're going to attempt to undermine the notion of one ruling authority in the name of democracy, I would still argue, use the perspective and think of having the foresight to question, would you... It's like a game of would you rather. Would you rather have one big governing authority and potentially lessen the role of democracy? Or would you rather make sure that people's rights are protected and upholded even if you don't believe them? It's like how I have friends that even if they don't understand LGBTQ plus concepts like asexuality or non-binary genders, they still respect them and accept them without being intolerant of them. And I think that's the most you could ask of anyone.
Or from a, you know, slightly more liberal perspective, you know, the idea that you support freedom of speech, even if that means you support the freedom of someone to say something offensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and anyway, as long as there's unfairness, you can't be just say, well, just take care about yourself. You have to speak about it and you can't be silent. Yeah, anyway, so just I have to ask again, so those decisions, is it a democratic decision or is it in consensus? So that would be important
these are,
to know as well.
These are purely simple majority votes.
Okay.
So
okay.
50% of the number of countries voting plus one. If they vote in favour, it passes. So that's the same decision that's going to be passed in this particular instance. I should point out, however, that I think we can agree that upholding human rights, upholding LGBT rights, is of paramount importance.
Definitely.
But at the same time, understanding the context still needs to come into play. Again, I'm using a personal example here, so do forgive me for it, but from a Bangladeshi perspective, it is actually a more conservative approach that LGBT rights movements are taking. They're saying this is not about becoming a forward-thinking 21st century liberal country. We are actually tapping back into our old traditions. We're tapping back into traditions that have existed in Bangladesh before Bangladesh itself was a country, where sexuality and gender were private matters and the government didn't rule on them. So they are coming from a very conservative approach. Now, that is still protecting LGBT rights, but it's going against this progressive neoliberal idea of rights for all. I would argue that's still very effective, because what you're doing is you're tapping into an understanding of rights that is more easily understood by the majority of the local population, but you're still protecting the rights. And I think that is where the distinction needs to be made. Not that rights shouldn't be protected because the West supports them, quote unquote, but that rights need to be upheld using the different contexts and using them in the right way.
Yeah, it's kind of like when we're talking about what role should the government play in our personal and private lives. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to be too nanny state, but at the same time, if you have a society where there is very little to no legal protection for LGBT plus individuals, if there is very little sex education, if there's very little healthcare, you're allowing a lot of people to go unheard and unprotected, and it's just, it doesn't make for a very effective citizenship.
We have reached the end of the show, unfortunately. I realise that's quite an abrupt end, but it's been a very engaging discussion. At the moment of this show, the final vote regarding the African bloc's resolution still hasn't passed, so keep an eye out on our social media profiles where we will be updating the results of that as and when they come in. If anyone has felt triggered or feels emotionally drained after listening to the contents of this show, please be aware that Nottingham Nightline is a very good resource and the LGBT network has a welfare team that can be reached. Do also keep an eye out on the LGBT network's website, where we will be posting the full audio of this show as well as an update on the vote.